general, one with relative ease, and he then returned with his army to the Arab base at Divin. However, Walid had evidently decided that it was time to teach the Armenians a lesson. The Arab commander of the district of Nakhchivan was ordered to summon a number of the Armenian nobles under the pretext of including them in the official register and to distribute payments, which is explained as the official maintenance given to the Armenian nobles and their cavalry, indicating that the old Sasanian system of granting subsidies to the nobles had been continued by the Arabs. However, once they were assembled, he confined them in a great church and set fire to it, thus incinerating them, and he allowed their women to be taken as spoil. News of this massacre evidently circulated widely, for it was recorded in Armenian, Byzantine, and Muslim sources. It prompted many Armenian nobles to flee their country. Sumbat Bagratuni left with his clan to Phasis on the Black Sea coast, where the Byzantines allowed him to establish a safe haven. However, when Walid felt that his point had been made, he recalled Muhammad and dispatched a certain Abdulaziz ibn Hatim as governor of Armenia, 706-709, who receives a surprisingly positive write-up in the Armenian sources. He had poor hearing, but was a man of prudence, full of earthly wisdom, a teller of stories and proverbs. He pacified the country by protecting it from all unjust attacks. He issued an oath in writing, guaranteeing the lives and property of the nobles, and thus persuaded them to return to their ancestral seats. Prudently, though, he fortified the city of Divin to give greater protection to the Arab garrison stationed there, installing new gates and a moat around the city walls. Possibly the reason for the more favorable attitude toward Armenia, which extended also to the other Caucasian polities, Georgia and Albania, was that the Arabs now faced a growing threat to the north, namely the Khazars, and so it made sense to keep their southern Caucasian vassals loyal. The mixing of Arabs and non-Arabs. For the first 50 years or so after the death of Muhammad, there was a quite clear demarcation between the conquerors and the conquered. The former were mostly Arabs and mostly Muslims, though not as uniformly so as later histories suggest, and the latter were mostly non-Arabs and very few had converted to Islam. The conquerors were mostly soldiers, who received stipends and lived in garrisons, while the conquered were civilians, who paid taxes and lived in villages and cities. Given that the conquerors were enormously successful and enjoyed many privileges and access to power, it was inevitable that some of the conquered would want to join them. This was not so easy initially, but the situation gradually changed as a result of policy decisions of Abdulmalik and his immediate successors, and a great mingling of peoples and traditions from North Africa to Central Asia was set in motion that resulted ultimately in the emergence of a new civilization, what we call Islamic civilization. It was a complex process, which involved the adoption by the conquered people of the religion, Islam, and identity, Arab, of the conquerors. This did not happen in a passive manner, but rather the two ingredients of Islam and Arab identity were refashioned and reformulated by those who took them on. This last point is worth emphasizing, since both medieval Muslim and modern Western histories often give the impression that the Arabs conquered and imposed their values and identity on a passive native population, whereas in reality, the latter, over time, absorbed the Arabs and reshaped their values. To understand this, it is worth thinking about numbers. It is very difficult to estimate pre-modern populations, but the order of magnitude we should think of is about 250,000 to 300,000 Arab conquerors settling among some 25 million to 30 million conquered residents, so approximately one Arab to 100 non-Arabs. since for the first half century the Arabs mostly lived apart in garrisons rather than settling among the conquered, they were not immediately assimilated. However, they brought back to their garrisons huge numbers of prisoners of war from all the lands that they had conquered, in part to remove able fighting men from potentially rebellious regions, and in part to use them as personal valets and household servants, as tutors and scribes, as wives and concubines. This inevitably eroded the barriers between the conquerors and the conquered, and it was facilitated by the fact that the generation of Arabs that had emigrated from Arabia and the Syrian steppe to join the jihad were now mostly dead, and a large proportion of their descendants had grown up far away from their parents' native lands, in garrisons in the urban landscapes of Egypt, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. In short, it was not long before blood was mixed, boundaries were blurred, and religion and society were fast transformed. Conversion of non-Arabs to Islam. A crucial aspect of this transformation was the conversion of the conquered population to Islam. Thus, Islam acted as a medium whereby non-Arabs could join the conquest elite and consequently could play a role in shaping its culture and ideology. The Arab conquerors do not seem to have expected or planned for this to happen. God had ordained that the conquered people would be the Arabs' booty, not their equals. Later Muslim historians maintained that the conquerors had offered their opponents the opportunity to convert before fighting them, but this is never mentioned in earlier sources. As John of Fenech observed, "Of each person they required only tribute, allowing him to remain in whatever faith he wished." However, since neither the Quran nor Muhammad had put up any bar to conversion, it is not surprising, given that it offered the chance of partaking in the privileges of the conquerors, that many aspired to it. The only snag was that to convert one had to have an Arab patron, in the early period at least. The Arabs initially thought along tribal lines, and so required that those who were joining the ranks of the Muslims become affiliated with a tribe. This was, in some ways, a practical measure, for being a member of a tribe meant that if you fell on hard times or were the victim and/or perpetrator of a crime, your fellow tribesmen would take responsibility for you. But it also meant, ostensibly at least, that non-Arabs were taking on aspects of the conqueror's world, Arabizing, such as an Arab name and the genealogical outlook of the tribal system. Many non-Arabs who had status in their own community balked at having to submit themselves to an Arab patron. However, this issue did not arise for those who had been taken captive, for they were assigned as booty to an Arab. They were wrenched away from their family and friends and their homeland, and taken off to the garrison towns to perform a variety of jobs. In this predominantly Muslim milieu, there was a strong inducement to convert to Islam. Conversion was no guarantee of manumission, but many would have built up good relations with their masters, who often agreed to free them to deepen the bond between them, or in return for a fixed period of service or monthly payments. This transformed them from a captive into a freedman. Many of these captives ended up in Arab households, supplying services of various kinds. For example, one papyrus preserves a register for the maintenance of the household of Abdulaziz ibn Marwan, brother of the Caliph Abdulmalik and the governor of Egypt, 685 to 704, and there we find numerous freedmen acting as secretaries, physicians, messengers, tailors, saddlers, sailors, and laborers. There are also free Christian Egyptians on the register, among them Athanasius Bar Gumai, a nobleman from northern Mesopotamia, who is described as being responsible for general affairs in the various provinces, and is assigned a team of 44 secretaries. He joined the Arab government of his own volition, as a free man, who had never been enslaved, but more commonly, former captives staffed the higher echelons of the regime. A good example is Rajah ibn Haywa. He was originally from Meishan province in southern Iraq, where he was captured by a warrior of the tribe of Kinda and settled with him in the Palestine-Jordan region. His manifest abilities brought him to the attention of the Caliph Abd al-Malik, whom he served in a number of capacities, as tutor for his son Suleiman, as a financial manager for the construction of the Dome of the Rock on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, and as an emissary on certain important diplomatic missions. Contemporary evidence for conversion among non-Arabs in the early decades of Arab rule is very rare. There is the report of the Egyptian chronicler John of Nicaea that when the Arabs' invasion began to succeed, some of his countrymen apostatized from the Christian faith and embraced the faith of the beast. But it is not until the reign of Abd al-Malik that reports about conversion to Islam start to become common in our contemporary sources. The phenomenon evidently worried some Christian authorities, who censured any who abandoned their community and their faith, especially when they did so without being subjected to any compulsion, lashings, or blows. Others were pragmatic, such as Jacob, bishop of Edessa, died 708, who issued advice to his flock on this matter. For example, he ruled that penitent apostates close to death may receive the Eucharist. Christians who become Muslim and then return to Christianity do not need rebaptism, but they should observe a period of penance. And Christian wives of Muslims who threaten to convert to Islam unless given the Eucharist should be granted it, but with an appropriate penalty. The rate of conversion varied substantially from community to community. The Jews had long before adapted to living as a minority under foreign rule, and so probably fared best. The Christians had a history of resistance against the pagan Romans, which they could draw upon for strength and inspiration, and the anti-Chalcedonians among them had already established their own independent hierarchy in the period before Islam, which meant that they were well-placed to take advantage of the virtual self-rule that the Arabs expected of them. Zoroastrian communities survived in mountainous and remote areas quite well, but in the cities, where they had, in any case, been losing ground to Christianity in the 6th century, they seemed to founder after the loss of state patronage, and so more readily renounced their faith. The speed of conversion was also linked to the potential for interaction and intermarriage with Muslims, for the children of mixed marriages were always counted as Muslims by the state. In Egypt, where the Muslim presence was light for the first 2 centuries of Arab rule, conversion was very slow, and Islam only became the majority religion around the 14th century. In Iraq and Khorasan, however, which bore the brunt of early Muslim settlement, opportunities for social intercourse were numerous and conversion correspondingly more frequent, with Muslims being a majority by the 10th century, if not before. Non-Arabs and the evolution of Islam. Inevitably, many of these converts, and even more so their descendants who had been born into Islam, wanted to explore and expound their new religion and to reconcile it with their former faith and culture. Additionally, scholarship was a way for newcomers and the lowborn to attain respect and status. "If it were not for our expertise in the sayings of Muhammad," observed one non-Arab religious authority, "we would be on a par with greengrocers." Since Islam had no clergy, and in its early stages had no colleges to restrict accreditation, scholarship was open to all who had the time, inclination, and ability to pursue it. Numerous converts availed themselves of this opportunity and dedicated themselves to elaborating a new worldview. There are too many to even begin to list them, but here are a few of the most famous. Muqattil ibn Suleiman, died 767, a captive from Balkh, author of the earliest extant Quran commentary. Yazid ibn Abi Habib died 746, son of a captive from Nubia, the top legal authority in Egypt of his generation. Ibn Ishaq died 767, grandson of a captive from Ain al-Tamr in Iraq, author of the most famous biography of Muhammad. Ibn Jurayj died 767, grandson of a captive from Anatolia, a prolific collector of sayings of Muhammad. Abu Hanifa died 767, grandson of a captive from Kabul, eponymous founder of a law school. And Hamad Arawiya died 772, son of a captive from Daylam, an expert on ancient Arabic poetry. Although all of these men attained maturity later than the period treated in this chapter, they were all born during the reign of Abd al-Malik or Walid and were, in effect, the product of the Islamizing policies of these two rulers. The conquerors themselves realized that non-Arab converts were starting to ascend the social ladder of their society, as is illustrated by a number of contemporary anecdotes. One relates how the scholar Ibn Shahab az-Zuhri went to see the caliph, Abd al-Malik, who asked him about who was the top religious authority in the key regions and cities of the empire: Arabia, Egypt, Syria, the Jazeera, Khorasan, Basra, and Kufa, and whether they were Arab Muslim or non-Arab Muslim. In every case, except for Kufa, they were non-Arab Muslims. This prompted the caliph to exclaim that the non-Arabs are going to predominate over the Arabs to such an extent that they will preach to them from the pulpits, with the Arabs down below listening. But, Commander of the Faithful, retorts Ibn Shahab, it is all a matter of religion. Whosoever assimilates it will be in charge, and whoever neglects it will lose out. The story is quite possibly apocryphal, but it nicely illustrates that the definition of what it meant to be Arab was changing. Abd al-Malik is holding to the old definition, what we might call an ethnic Arab, a person who is, and whose parents and grandparents were, a full member of an Arabian tribe, not one who has become, or whose parents or grandparents became, an affiliated member of such a tribe, a freedman, mawla. More and more, though, this ethnic qualification for being an Arab, in which genealogical and geographical elements predominated, became irrelevant, and a cultural definition began to take hold. Someone who spoke Arabic, had an Arab name, and signed up to the evolving cultural and moral norms of the conquest society. Soon it became difficult to tell these cultural Arabs apart from ethnic Arabs. When the question was posed, for example, about Ibrahim an-Nakhai, died 713, who went on to become an accomplished Muslim jurist, whether he was a real, that is, ethnic Arab or not, no one was sure, and so they had to check in the military register under the tribe of Naha, and he was found to be inscribed there as a non-Arab client of this tribe. In another case, a soldier of the Tamim al-Ijli tribe encountered on the North Iranian frontier a man whose family he knew, and who asserted that he was directly descended from the tribe's forebear, al-Ijl. "Your father did not try to trace his descent among the Arabs," he said to him, "but rather among the Persians, so how can you claim that al-Ijl is your ancestor?" To which the man replied, "My mother told me so." Of course, prejudice and backbiting about who was a real Arab went on in some quarters, especially on the part of Arabs of good pedigree who had a vested interest in preserving the old definition of Arab identity, and who were worried about being swamped by the newcomers. Gradually, however, this new definition of Arabhood took hold, as is evident from a number of sayings put into the mouth of the Prophet Muhammad that espoused an inclusive definition of being an Arab, the most liberal of which simply stated that whoever speaks Arabic is an Arab. One could say that the Arab Empire became an immigrant society, but people were not migrating from one country to another, although some were doing that as well, but from the ranks of the conquered to the society of the conquerors. And quite quickly we pass from a conquest society composed mainly of ethnic Arabs to a cosmopolitan immigrant society where Muslims are from everywhere, even though many, and especially their descendants, become labeled Arab. So Arab becomes a term like American, applied to people with very different roots but who have shared cultural values and a common language. Already by the end of the Umayyad period, we find Muslims of non-Arab origin in all walks of life and at all levels of society below that of the caliph himself. It was initially frowned upon for them to marry Arab Muslims, and only those with high status and good connections managed it. For instance, the Caliph Yazid I's maternal aunt married a freedman, but only his brother dared joke openly that she had been given away to a slave. And Qaddam ibn Sulayman, grandson of a captive from Isfahan, was able to marry an Arab woman of the Banul Jarud because of his position as a senior financial secretary in the Umayyad administration and the high status of the Arab family that he was affiliated to. However, these restrictions began to lapse over time, especially when the Umayyad dynasty was overthrown in 750 by men from East Iran and Transoxania, a majority of whom were non-Arabs. Non-Arabs in the army. It was not only in the religious sphere that non-Arabs made their mark, but also in the military world, although this was at first harder for them to break into. The conquering armies had initially consisted principally of Arab tribes. Except for certain groups with recognized martial qualities, such as the Luwata Berbers, the Daylamis, elite Sasanian cavalry units, and so on, non-Arabs served in the military only in an ancillary role, as craftsmen, laborers, guides, personal assistants, and the like. The tribal nature of the army made accommodating non-tribal recruits difficult, and it was only done for special cases. The Sasanian cavalry, for example, were repackaged as a unit of the East Arabian tribe of Tamim. However, tribes were unwieldy to mobilize and keep in the field, and they became caught up in political issues, as the Second Civil War showed. Abd al-Malik's right-hand man, Hajjaj ibn Yusuf, decided therefore to professionalize the army. Chiefs and tribes were gradually replaced with generals and regiments. He also took the opportunity to reform the expensive remuneration system, replacing stipends as a reward for past participation in conquests with a regular salary for continuing military service. In effect, he created a professional standing army, and those Arabs who did not want to be full-time soldiers dropped out and became civilians. The way was now open for non-Arabs to enter the army, and there were two particular factors driving their enrollment. On the demand side, the intense and bitter confrontations between various Arab groups, beginning with the Second Civil War, prompted the various contenders to try to gain a numerical advantage by employing non-Arabs. For example, when more and more slaves of the Muslims began escaping to join the Byzantine-led insurrection in the mountains of Lebanon, Abd al-Malik had a herald go out and proclaim that any slaves who returned would be freed and would have his name inscribed in the army register, a promise that he fulfilled and placed them in a unit of their own. Mundhir ibn Azubair complained to his brother Abdullah, who was competing with Abd al-Malik for the caliphate, that in the course of fighting his opponents he had to face Aramean peasants. And this became a frequent criticism of the Syrian troops, namely, that alongside them fought a medley of non-Arab groups. As the rebel Yazid ibn al-Muhallab said to his followers before they marched against an oncoming Syrian army in 720, "There have come against you Berbers, Slavs, Jaramica, Copts, Aramean peasants, and a motley assortment of folk." Such statements were, of course, intended as insults, but there was enough truth in them to make them credible, and it is in line with what one expects from a successful imperial army. This development reached a peak in the time of the early Abbasids, whose armies, as someone who watched them in action in the Jazeera in the 760s reported, consisted of a mixture of all nations. They were called the clients of the caliph, and they included Sindhis, Alans, Khazars, Medes, Persians, Kufans, Arabs, Khurasanis, and Turks. On the supply side, the Arabs found that there was no shortage of non-Arab volunteers. It was well known that you only have to let a herald announce that whoever converts will be freed of taxes and 50,000 Muslims will come to you ready to serve on your behalf. Not only did you not pay taxes in the army, but you also received wages, and so there were many among the conquered people who were willing to sign up. This availability, when combined with the frequency of revolt among the Arabs, meant that caliphs, governors, and even some powerful and/or wealthy individuals began to acquire whole retinues of freedmen and occasionally of slaves. And it was not only Arab potentates. During the Second Arab Civil War, Persian noblemen are recorded as fighting alongside Arab generals using their own freedmen and slaves. Many such retinues were presumably of mixed provenance, but some were derived from a specific location, such as the Kikaniya from modern southwest Pakistan and Bukhariya from Bukhara, or recruited by a specific person who presumably commanded the retinue on behalf of its master. The Wadahiya, for example, were led by a Berber freedman of the Umayyads named Wadda, and this office passed to his descendants. One is reminded of the late Roman Bucellarii, private armies that were equipped and paid for by various magnates and that acted like personal bodyguards or elite units. However, a more likely model is the pre-Islamic Central Asian institution of Chakars, professional soldiers recruited from the general population by Turco-Sogdian nobles to whom they were personally loyal and to whom they were bound, at least on some occasions, by a concept of fictional adoption. These were men of ardent valor, wrote the 7th century pilgrim Xuanzang, who looked upon death as a return to their kindred and against whom no foe could stand. Initially, non-Arabs were only found in the rank and file of the military, but gradually they managed to work their way up into the officer grades. The career of Hayyan an-Nabati, died 720, is instructive. The general Maskala ibn Hubayra picked him up either while a governor in Fars or on campaign in Tabaristan, or else in one of the slave markets of Basra or Kufa. We do not know about Hayyan's early career, but we find him as commander of the non-Arab forces in Khurasan in the early 8th century. He was particularly esteemed as a negotiator of truces and treaties with rulers in Iran, presumably because he himself had belonged to the Persian nobility and spoke Persian. His son Muqattil became one of the most famous scholars of Balkh, and because of the respect he gained thereby, various eastern governors employed him as a messenger and mediator on their behalf. In 747, he commanded the pro-Umayyad forces at Balkh, illustrating how integral to the Arab army non-Arabs had now become. Non-Arabs in revolts. The non-Arab Muslims that we hear most about in our sources are those who joined the Arab Muslim establishment, but there were some who decided to oppose it, teaming up with a variety of different rebels, both Arab and non-Arab, Muslim and non-Muslim. There were many such movements, and it is worth looking at a couple of illustrative examples. The first concerns an insurrection that occurred during the Second Arab Civil War in Nisibis, a strategic town on the modern Turkish-Syrian border. Byzantines and Persians had fought over it in the past, and now, according to the monk John of Fennec, who lived nearby, it was being claimed by both the ruling Umayyad clan and by anti-government rebels. The latter were led by Mukhtar ibn Abi Ubaid, who claimed to be acting on behalf of a son of the Caliph Ali. Angry with the Arabs of Kufa when they lost a battle to the Umayyads, he gave orders that all their slaves should be liberated and go into battle in their master's stead. These slaves then rallied round Mukhtar in the thousands, and all that they had in their hands was either a sword or a spear or a stick. They were, says John, slaves of captive origin, and include among themselves all the peoples under heaven. In August 686, they participated in a battle on the river Khazir, near Mosul, on the side of Mukhtar and against the Umayyad governor Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad. The latter was defeated, and the slaves then entered Nisibis and held it, and drove off all who tried to take it from them. They slew the general appointed over them by Mukhtar's right-hand man, along with all his comrades, for they preferred to have someone from their own ranks as commander, and not one who belonged to the Arabs. Others of captive origin collected together and joined those who were in the city of Nisibis. Every day more would turn up from every quarter and join them. They captured a number of fortresses, and the fear of them fell on all the Arabs. The Muslim sources confirm that a kind of slave revolt was taking place, though they are only concerned with the Arab reaction to this. "Our slaves are rebelling against us," complained the Kufan notables. "Yet they are our booty which God has granted us together with these lands." John makes it clear that we have here a rebellion of men removed from their homelands and forced into a life of servitude in the strange environment of the Arab garrison towns, and who have now seized the opportunity afforded them by Mukhtar to rebel against their masters. Not all in Mukhtar's forces were slaves, as opposed to freedmen still serving their masters. The Arabic sources usually refer to slaves and freedmen, but those in possession of Nisibis were clearly all prisoners of war, resentful against their Arab captors and seeking their freedom. The guerrilla troops that the Emperor Constantine IV let loose in the Lebanese mountains in the 670s evidently tapped into the same well of resentment, for their ranks were likewise swelled by runaway captives. The Arab conquests had led to the capture and displacement of huge numbers of people, and now that the Arab Empire seemed to be unraveling, many of these prisoners of war were seizing the opportunity to escape their servitude. It is interesting to see just how many and how susceptible to recruitment they were. Within 50 years of the conquests, they had been enrolled as participants in Arab power politics, a harbinger of things to come. However, in the end, because they were neither well-equipped nor well-trained, they were no match for the experienced Arab troops once the latter had patched up their differences and ended their civil war. A second example is provided by the exploits of Musa ibn Abdallah ibn Khazim, who, upon the assassination of his father, gathered round him some of his own Arab tribesmen and a number of local toughs, Sa'alik, and crossed into Transoxania in search of adventure. They were generally moved on by nobles nervous of their intentions, but the lord of Tirmid, a fortified town on the river Oxus, gave them hospitality. He was to regret this, for Musa decided to make this his home and ousted his host in unceremonious fashion. He and his followers ran what was effectively a little city-state, and their ranks were soon swelled by men of diverse backgrounds, all with a grudge against the Umayyads and their governors. The most illustrious guests were the brothers Hureith and Thabit Qutba, local aristocrats who had converted to Islam and attached themselves to an Arab tribe, but had been insulted by Yazid ibn al-Muhallab, the governor of Khorasan, 702-704 and 715-717, and now offered their services to Musa. Arab and Turk armies tried at different times to wrest Tirmid from Musa, but all were repulsed. He only met his demise when the coalition of Arabs and locals that he had forged began to come apart, and the two sides ended up by destroying each other. Musa was successful for a long time at binding together the different groups, in part because he himself was a product of two worlds. His father, Abdullah ibn Khazim, of the tribe of Sulaym from West Arabia, had grown up in an Arab tribal setting and fought in Arab armies in numerous campaigns on the eastern frontier. But Musa's mother was the daughter of the ruler of Azdawar, near Qumis in North Iran, and Musa had spent most of his time in the east. In the epic account of his exploits, he comes across as someone who transcended the black and white categories of Arab, non-Arab, Muslim, non-Muslim, and high-born, low-born, and illustrates how shifting, ambiguous, and complex were the relations between these various groups. Chapter 6. Retrenchment and Revolt, 715 to 750. The period up to 715 witnessed a huge expansion of the Arab Empire, as far as North Africa and Spain in the west, and as far as Sindh and Transoxania in the east. The Caliph Suleiman, 715 to 717, had hoped to extend these successes and to crown them with the capture of the ultimate prize, Constantinople, but a two-year siege in 717 to 718 ended in a total failure and the loss of most of the invasion force. This not only drew to a close the dream of adding Byzantium to the list of defeated enemies, but it also encouraged other peoples to challenge Arab suzerainty and contributed toward the stalling of the conquest juggernaut. Substantial defeats at the hands of the Franks, Khazars, Turks, and Indians in the 730s put limits on the extent of Arab rule. Then, in 740, Berber revolts erupted across North Africa, which resulted in the secession of segments of that region from Arab control and the emergence of local dynasties, a phenomenon that would spread across the empire in the 9th century. The position of Byzantium had looked a little precarious following the loss of Carthage in 698 and a string of defeats in Anatolia in the ensuing decade. However, the competent Emperor Leo, 717 to 741, managed to keep the resolve of the Byzantines steady in the face of the Arab siege of their capital, and buoyed up by this success, he was able to complete the process begun by Constance and Constantine IV of ensuring that Byzantium had the strength and resources to survive and to some degree flourish for another few centuries. Leo capped his achievements with a victory in 740 against a large Arab army comprising 20,000 cavalry, which had advanced into Phrygia, west-central Anatolia, under the command of the renowned warrior Abdallah al-Battal. The Arabs were surrounded and massacred to a man. As one Christian observer noted, such a disaster had never befallen the Arabs before. After a century on the defensive, Byzantium had now regained its confidence and was willing once more to engage Arab armies in the field rather than just to cower in their fortresses. The Arabs were thus obliged to acknowledge, albeit tacitly and grudgingly, that the Byzantines, along with the Khazars, Franks, and Indians, were not, for the time being at least, going to be subjugated. Yet this was no doom and gloom time for the Arab rulers. They were now beginning to feel comfortable with their newfound wealth and set about spending it on visual displays of their piety and power. Walid I, 705 to 715, inaugurated this activity by erecting the elegant and beautiful Mosque of Damascus, so that Muslims could feel proud that they had a prayer place to rival the splendid churches of the Christians. His successors followed eagerly in his footsteps, commissioning an impressive number of public and private structures. Suleiman built palaces, gardens, and mills by the spring of Jericho, and contemporary Christians marveled at the many villas, shops, hostels, and gardens constructed by the Caliph Hisham, 724 to 743. Many of these monumental edifices are still standing, or have been recovered archaeologically, and attest to a major building program by the Umayyads and their associates, a dramatic demonstration in stone of their earthly might. Their detractors would say, however, that too much power and wealth was in the hands of this one family. Walid, Suleiman, and Hisham were all sons of Abd al-Malik, as was Yazid II, 720 to 724, and Umar II, 717 to 720, and Marwan II, 743 to 750, were his nephews. This narrow concentration of power ensured a stable succession for a while, but it also stoked increasing resentment, which culminated in a whole series of revolts in the 740s and the overthrow of the Umayyad family in 750, together with their network of Syrian supporters. Constantinople and Anatolia. When Suleiman came to the throne in 715, the Muslim year 100, AD 718, was fast approaching, and this was trumpeted as the year when Muslim rule would triumph across the known world. Hoping to fulfill this prediction, Suleiman pledged, "I shall not cease from the struggle with Constantinople until either I conquer it or I destroy the entire dominion of the Arabs in trying." The caliph's brother, Maslama, was to mastermind the expedition. He mustered a huge army and built 5,000 ships, which he filled with troops and provisions. He assembled 12,000 workmen, 6,000 camels, which he loaded with weaponry and catapults, and 6,000 mules for transporting provisions. On top of this, 3,000 volunteers signed up to supplement the regular soldiers. They belonged, according to a Syrian source, to the class of Arabs without possessions, and presumably they went along in the hope of gaining divine credit and earthly spoils. Arab financiers provided mounts for the troops on the basis of hire or sale, in the expectation of being recompensed from the booty to be extracted from the imperial city. As with previous attempts on Constantinople, the attack was to be two-pronged. Suleiman ibn Mu'adh was to proceed by land, and Umar ibn Hubayra by sea. After an extended march to the city of Amorium in west-central Anatolia, Suleiman encountered there the Byzantine general Leo. He reached an understanding with the Arabs, leading them to believe that he would help them capture Constantinople, and in return, Maslama gave orders that no one should do any harm in Leo's region, not even taking a loaf of bread. For his part, Leo commanded that a traveling market should be loaded up for the Arabs, and the Byzantines bought and sold in good faith and without fear. Leo's real aim was to seize the imperial office for himself, as he thought that he was best qualified to protect Byzantium from the Arabs, but inevitably Byzantine citizens who saw him in the company of enemy troops were very nervous of his intentions. At Amorium, he went right up to the walls and spoke with the leaders and the foremost men of the city, explaining to them that his objective was not at all to betray the Byzantines, and that his relationship with Maslama was a pretense designed to save his country from destruction. Perceiving that Leo was indeed the man best suited to be emperor, they exchanged with him oaths of allegiance. Troops dispatched by Emperor Theodosius happened to arrive shortly thereafter with orders to kill Leo, but when they reached the latter's camp and the two armies met, the Byzantines on Leo's side and those who had been sent by Theodosius agreed unanimously to crown Leo. Then they all marched to the imperial city, where the citizens welcomed them with a festive escort and deposed Theodosius in the spring of 717. In the meantime, the main body of the Arab troops had spent the winter of 716 to 717 in Anatolia, while Maslama had sent Suleiman ibn Mu'adh with 12,000 men to lay siege to the city of Chalcedon, on the east side of the Bosphorus facing Constantinople, in order to cut off supplies from that approach to the capital, and to lay waste and pillage Byzantine territory in general. Map 4.1. When Maslama heard that Leo had become emperor, he was overjoyed, supposing that the latter would soon find an opportunity to fulfill his promise and deliver the city to him, and Leo wrote constantly to Maslama, encouraging him in these vain hopes. At the same time, he was fortifying the city, gathering into it plenty of supplies and readying ships for combat. Furthermore, he came to a financial arrangement with the Bulgars, so that they would assist in the defense of the city. Eventually, Maslama realized Leo's deceit, and he made ready his army and his ships, and in June of 717, he crossed over into Europe. Leo, for his part, had received intelligence about Maslama's movements, and he sent men to scorch the earth in the whole region to the west of the city, and to cut off the roads by which provisions were brought to the Arab army from Syria. Maslama's army erected a huge camp outside the west walls of the city, opposite the southern Golden Gate. They dug a wide trench between the camp and the city, and another one behind it, between the camp and the Bulgars, and they protected the whole by building a breast-high parapet of dry stone. On the 1st of September, the naval support arrived. Enormous ships, military transports, and light ships to the number of 1,800. However, the wind then dropped, and the big ships, heavily laden, found themselves becalmed. Leo had prepared for this eventuality and sent against them fire-bearing vessels. The Arab armada was a sitting target. Some ships were cast up burning by the sea walls, others sank to the bottom with their crews, and others were swept away in flames. Unfortunately, the winter of 717 to 718 proved particularly harsh. So much snow fell that the ground was made invisible for 100 days. With provisions now in short supply, the Arab troops were in a perilous situation, and matters were made worse by the frequent deadly stealth attacks of the Bulgars, whom the Arabs came to fear more than the Byzantines. They dreaded going back without their caliph's permission, and in any case the sea was so rough that it prevented them from leaving. Constrained thus on every side, with the specter of death before their eyes, they abandoned all hope. As for Maslama, he deluded the Arab army with the promise that very soon the Byzantines would surrender the city and that donations and supplies would arrive from Syria. The Byzantines had inflicted such deprivation on the Arabs that they had begun to eat dead animals and dung. In the Arab camp, a measure of wheat had reached the price of 10 gold coins, and a head of livestock was being sold for 2 or 3 gold coins. Many of them used to walk down to the ships and tear off a piece of pitch and chew on it all day long. While they were in these dire straits, the Caliph Suleiman died, and so did his son, to whom the Arabs had sworn allegiance as his father's successor. Succession passed instead to Umar, a nephew of the Caliph Abd al-Malik, a softly spoken man with a reputation for piety and sincerity. As soon as he became ruler, he put all his energies into rescuing those Arabs trapped in the Byzantine Empire. First, he arranged for fleets to bring them supplies. 400 transporters laden with grain made their way to Constantinople from Egypt, and a further 360 transporters came with arms and provisions from Africa. However, on their arrival, some of the Egyptian Christian crew sneaked out by night on skiffs, sought refuge in the city, and apprised its inhabitants of the 2 Arab fleets hidden in the bay. At once, Leo dispatched light boats with fire-throwing equipment, and these were able to sink some ships and put the rest to flight. Laden with what cargo they could salvage from the wrecks, the Byzantine crews returned in triumph to Constantinople. On receiving news of this, Umar concluded that he had no recourse but to call off the siege. He sent an envoy bearing a stern letter to Maslama, in which he warned against causing the ruin of the Arab army and ordered him to decamp. Maslama at first tried to conceal the command from the troops, but they came to know what the caliph had ordered and proclaimed it publicly throughout the camp. Caliph Umar has commanded you to leave and to return to your own country. In the summer of 718, they began their long journey home. Some looked to leave by sea and embarked on the remaining ships, but even then they were harried, for a storm overtook them and sank most of the ships. The survivors clung to the wreckage and were driven over to the shores of the country of Thrace, while others ended up on remote isles and were marooned there. Caliph Umar sent troops with mules and horses to escort those who had come away by land, for all their livestock had either been eaten or perished of starvation. He also sent food and money, and he issued a call throughout his empire to everyone who had a brother or other relative in the army under Maslama's command to accompany him home. Many went out to meet them and did all they could do to save them. France and the Franks. The Arabs initially fared much better in the far west. The decentralized nature of the Gothic kingdom had made it easy for them to practice divide and rule and to win over many local nobles with generous terms of surrender, allowing them to retain their lands and autonomy. Matters were very different, however, in the land of the Franks, and here the Arab-Berber forces faced much stiffer resistance. In the 720s, a series of Arab governors launched campaigns against the Franks, even besieging Toulouse, but without achieving any lasting success. The last and greatest attack, commanded by the governor Abd al-Rahman ibn Abdallah al-Rafiqi, 730 to 732, began as an attempt to capture the Berber chief Munuza, who had gone over to the Franks and married the daughter of Odo, the Duke of Aquitaine. Abd al-Rahman besieged him in his mountain hideout in the Pyrenees. When water became scarce, Munuza fled. But, wounded, he could not outrun his pursuers, and so he threw himself off a cliff, impaling himself on the sharp rocks beneath, out of a desperate desire to avoid being captured alive. Abd al-Rahman took the opportunity to raid deep into Frankish territory. He crossed the Garonne and Dordogne rivers and confronted Odo, who slipped away when it became evident that the battle was going badly for his side. Abd al-Rahman pursued him, plundering Tours on the way. Then, somewhere between Poitiers and Tours, in October 732, he encountered Charles, the powerful consul of Austrasia, the northeast sector of the Frankish kingdom. For 7 days, the two sides nervously eyed each other and tested each other with probing sorties. Finally, battle lines were drawn and the fight began. The northern peoples remained immobile like a wall, it is said, holding together like a glacier in the cold regions, and in the blink of an eye, they annihilated the Arabs with their swords. The triumph seemed a sign of divine favor to many Christians, and the Anglo-Saxon monk Bede summed it up with the words, "The Saracens who had wrought miserable slaughter on Gaul were punished for their faithlessness." There are almost no contemporary descriptions of this battle, and concrete details about it are hard to come by. Even its location is uncertain, and it tends to go by the name of one of the nearest of the two large towns, the Battle of Tours or the Battle of Poitiers. Gradually, however, its significance grew in the European imagination. Charles was hailed as a savior anointed by Christ, and he was later awarded the sobriquet of the Hammer, Martel. By early modern times, the battle had taken on enormous proportions, one of the most important encounters in the history of the world, when the world's fate was played out between the Franks and the Arabs, when Europe was saved from subjection to Asiatics and Africans. In characteristically vivid prose, Edward Gibbon had speculated that, were it not for Charles's victory, the Quran might be taught in the schools of Oxford, and her pulpits might demonstrate to a circumcised people the sanctity and truth of the revelation of Muhammad. Yet, though this defeat was a substantial one, it was not the reason that the Arabs achieved no further victories of note north of the Pyrenees. In fact, the very next governor after Abd al-Rahman undertook a new expedition against the Franks, but before he had even reached Zaragoza, he was informed by letter of the outbreak of a major revolt among the Berbers of Africa, and he hurried back to Cordoba. At this stage, there were mere rumblings of dissent, but in 740, a full-scale insurgency on many different fronts erupted and continued for a number of years as the Berbers openly shook their necks from the Arab yoke. Arab rule was never fully reinstated in the province of Africa, which witnessed instead the emergence of a variety of dynasties, some of local origin, some from outside. This meant that Arab-ruled Spain, known as Andalus, became somewhat cut off from the central government in Damascus, and this was made definitive when a son of the defeated Umayyad family, on the run from the Abbasid revolutionary armies that had toppled their regime in 750, installed himself as the province's new ruler. Losing the support of the caliphs, now based in Baghdad, meant that the Arab sovereigns of Andalus no longer had the manpower to embark upon expansion into other countries, and even in their core territory, they had to be careful to cultivate links with the Berber clans and the local Hispano-Roman aristocracies, lest these unite to eject them. North Africa and the Berbers. The Berber Rebellion of the 740s occurred in many of the same areas where there had been uprisings against the Byzantines 2 centuries before, but now the main Berber actors were not just Christians, but also Kharijite Muslims, who adhered to a form of Islam that opposed the monopolization of power by one clan and sought to make the post of caliph open to all and its holder accountable to his subjects. This suited well a people who felt little in common with the remote caliphs of Damascus and their Arab agents, and who were accustomed to chiefs of more humble standing. Their principal motive was probably still regional pride and dislike of domination by outsiders, as it had been in Byzantine times, though control of the lucrative trade in gold and slaves with sub-Saharan Africa also played a part. The Arab conquest was still recent, and the Arab presence principally limited to garrisons, and so much of the resident population would have viewed the Arabs as an alien occupying force and resented their meddling in local affairs. Though brief, notices in Christian chronicles do seem to confirm this sense of difference and remoteness. Many Saracens, that is, Arabs, were killed by the Romans, that is, natives, non-Arabs of Africa, and the people of Africa rebelled and killed their governor and every Muslim, that is, Arab, there. Our earliest Muslim account of the uprising says that the two initiators, one Berber and one Byzantine African, both converts to Islam, led coordinated revolts in August 740 at a prearranged time in the region of Tangiers. At the first major confrontation, in November of that year, the revolutionaries annihilated a large Arab force and killed a considerable number of the local Arab leaders, which led to this engagement being dubbed the Battle of the Nobles. A new governor of Africa was hastily dispatched from Damascus, and the following year he led a sortie against the Berbers, now under the command of a chief of the Zanata tribe, who were naked and wearing nothing but undergarments. Once more, however, the Arabs were defeated, and the new governor was slain. A certain Abd al-Wahid ibn Yazid of the Berber Hawara tribe, who had been acclaimed as their caliph, wiped out another Arab force during the autumn of 741. The Caliph Hisham appreciated that the situation was becoming critical, and so he sent his most experienced general, Hanzalah ibn Safwan of the powerful Syrian tribe of Kalb, to serve as the new governor of Africa with just one mandate: crush the insurrection. He arrived at Kairouan in March 742 with a huge army and immediately set about arming all adult males in the city so as to bolster his military strength even further. Abd al-Wahid approached Kairouan a couple of months later, but though he and his men put up a fierce fight, killing many of their enemy, they were outnumbered, and Hanzalah remorselessly pushed home his advantage until all opponents had died or fled. Although the dream of a unified Berber caliphate in Africa was shattered in 742, the region continued to drift away from central control from this time onward. Numerous local dynasties popped up across the region, some of them very long-lived, and many of them incorporating ingredients from Berber culture. For example, the Bargawata polity on Morocco's Atlantic coast endured for over four centuries, 744 to 1058. They allegedly had their own Berber holy family, beginning with the prophet Salih, used a Berber version of the Quran, and held to a number of Berber dietary and magical practices. This process culminated in the emergence of the two most powerful Berber kingdoms, the Almoravids, 1062 to 1147, and the Almohads, 1147 to 1248, who came closest to realizing the idea of a Berber empire, at one point holding the entire African littoral from Benghazi to the Atlantic and the southern part of Spain. Transoxania and the Turks. Over in the far east of the Arab Empire, Qutaybah ibn Muslim had conquered much of Central Asia in the course of the Caliphate of Walid, 705 to 715. When the latter died, Qutaybah seemed to fear that the new ruler, Suleiman, would dismiss him, and so he asked his men to rebel with him. They refused outright, and when he upbraided them, they fell upon him and killed him. A sad end for a great general. For the next 5 years, there was a lull in campaigning in the region. Suleiman had concentrated all his resources on Constantinople, and the failure of this venture made his successor, Umar II, wary of any further expansion. Sensing an opportunity, and encouraged by rumors that Arab rule was destined to last only one century, a number of Transoxanian nobles wrote to the Chinese emperor pleading for military support. The most interesting is that from Gurak, lord of Samarkand and king of Sogdia, 710 to 737, since it also gives an account of the Arab capture of the city. For 35 years we have been battling constantly against Arab, Ta-Shi, brigands. Every year we have sent on campaign great armies of soldiers and cavalrymen without having had the good fortune to receive any military aid from the Imperial Majesty. 6 years ago, the chief general of the Arabs, the Emir Qutaybah, came here with a huge army. He fought against us, and we suffered a great defeat at the hands of our enemies, and many of our men were killed or wounded. Since the infantry and cavalry of the Arabs were very numerous and our forces could not resist them, I withdrew into the fortress to protect myself. The Arabs then besieged the city. They set 300 catapults against the walls and breached them in three places. They wanted to destroy our city and our kingdom. I humbly request that the Imperial Majesty, being now informed, dispatch here a contingent of Chinese soldiers to help me in these difficult times. The king of the Sirkab Valley, southwest of Kabul, also sent an emissary to the Chinese court, complaining that all that was in my treasury and my storehouses, all my precious objects and jewels, as well as the riches of the people who are my subjects, have been appropriated by the Arabs, who carried them off for themselves. And the lord of Bukhara lamented that Every year we have suffered the incursions and ravages of the Arab brigands, and our country has enjoyed no respite. And he asked for an imperial decree ordering the Turks to come to his aid. Whether in response to a Chinese decree or not, the Western Turks did become actively involved in the resistance against the Arabs in Transoxania. Their fortunes were revived by the able leader Suluk, 715 to 738, who was chief of one of their subgroups known as the Turgesh. He is referred to by Chinese sources as Sulu, and described by them as a diligent and moderate man who loved and governed his people well. He had to fight on two fronts, the Eastern Turk Confederation to the east and the Arabs to the west. By marrying the daughters of the Eastern Turk leader, as well as of the King of Tibet, he placated his east flank. In 720 to 721, he turned his attention to the west and dispatched an army to campaign alongside some Sogdian nobles. Together they engaged an Arab contingent northeast of Samarkand, and though nothing decisive was achieved, it is clear that the Arabs were pushed onto the defensive. Emboldened by the entry into the fray of the Turgesh, some Sogdians rebelled against the